It's Monday night.
I've been in the game a long time. When a catcher catches the ball and it's strike three, you call the guy out. It's that simple, isn't it?
And if it's Monday, it's the knee jerks.
I'm not going to sit here and rip umpires. But you saw what you saw, clearly saw what you saw. I just saw it for the 10th time. Write it and say something once in a while. Have the nerve to say something.
Detroit Sports Talk with Attitude.
Attitude on three. One, two, three.
Attitude.
Coming up tonight, will Big Al guess whose birthday it is? Who are the jerks of the week? What will Eno rant about now? The answers coming up next. Two guys who know Detroit sports, the voice of reason, Greg Eno and Big Al Beaton.
It's March 12th, 2017. That means it's time for the Knee Jerks, Detroit Sports Talk with Eno and Big Al. I'm the Big Al of the equation, Al Beaton, longtime Detroit-based blogger and podcaster. We're kind of hunkered down this weekend after the huge windstorms we had come through the area this past week. And I know Chef Greg, otherwise known as Greg Eno of numerous places on the web. Well, I'm wondering how hunkered down you are, Greg. How's things on your end? Because it was a weird week in Michigan weather-wise.
Thanks, Al Beaton. We were very fortunate in Madison Heights not to lose any power, which is amazing considering two-thirds of the customers in the area lost power, basically. And we were fortunate enough not to have to go through that. Some of my friends are still just now getting their power back today. This was Wednesday afternoon. They've been out, and some are won't be back until Monday. So, indeed, very fortunate to not have to go through that. And I just want to give a shout out to all the folks I saw on Facebook who opened their homes to those who did not have power. I thought it was a very kind gesture. A lot of folks said, "Look, if you don't have power, come over here. We've got plenty of food. We've got warmth. We've got power. We've got room." And so I give a shout out to those folks for doing that, because that's what it's all about when you got to pull together when these kinds of things happen. And so that's the one of the positive things about social media. You can get a message like that out to people, to the masses. So, but yeah, it was a tough one. I am Greg Eno from Out of Bounds, my WordPress blog. Just Google that. Also, my Winged Wheeler Red Wings blog, also on WordPress. Check me out there. Follow me on Twitter at Greg Eno. Follow the Knee Jerks on Twitter at the Knee Jerks. And our blog, of course, is thekneejerks.us. Facebook is facebook.com/thekneejerks. Happy to let everybody know that we are indeed going to be graced with the presence of the lovely Linda McCoy-Marie, who's going to be talking about a new book she's got coming out about the Los Angeles Rams. And I know we are a Detroit-centric podcast here, but the Rams are such an iconic franchise in the NFL. And, of course, they moved back to Los Angeles last fall. And for the first time in a number of years, I think since 1995 was the last year in L.A., I think. So it was a long time coming. And we'll talk to Linda about the Rams' first year back in L.A. We'll talk about the Chargers going to L.A. We'll talk about, of course, the book and some other things she's got cooked. A very busy lady, Linda McCoy-Murray. She'll be joining us in a few minutes. We've got Lions off season, very busy off season so far, especially the past couple of days. Al and I will talk about that. We'll touch on maybe the NCAA tournament bracket, and we'll also talk some Tigers, I think, as well, heading into this podcast. 2 weeks from tonight, don't know who will be our guest, so we'll keep your eye out on social media for that. But before we get to any of that stuff, let's play a game we like to call Whose Birthday Is It, Maestro?
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear. Happy birthday.
Everybody knows how we play this game by now. I give Al a clue or two or three of an individual whose birthday it is today in the world of sports. And if Al can correctly guess that person within the first two clues, he will receive his choice between an autographed photograph or a photographed autograph, whatever is your choice, Al.
let's go back to things like Wizards and gift certificates to Adria Appliance or something. All right, well, fire away.
This person, Al, made his hay in the world of baseball. He was born on this date in 1956, so he's 61 years old today.
Okay.
He is not a Hall of Famer, but Some would make the case that he should be a Hall of Famer. He played his entire career in the National League. And I would tell you that he started out as a catcher, but made his name in the outfield.
Catcher, made his name in the outfield, could be in his late early 60s, but he played mostly in the 80s. Oh, geez. Let me go. Started a catcher, made his name. Good Lord. It's probably one of those ones that I'll probably, when you do tell me, or if I do come up with it, it'll be, how come I didn't think of this right away? But, oh, my goodness.
You're in a slump, too.
I know. I'm a big-time slump, and I'm still in a slump. Good Lord. No, it must be these lame gifts. I think that has something to do with it. I'm going to pass on this one. I got to ponder a little bit and hope for
number
two so I can get my autograph, photograph, graph thingy. So regardless of that, we have one of our favorite guests coming back, Greg, so let's get to it.
Yeah, and it's nice to have Linda on at a time where it's not our anniversary show. Usually we're talking to Linda in May when we celebrate our annual anniversary, but not this time. She's joining us here in March talking about her new book called The L.A. Rams Home Again, which is a bunch of columns culled from the years 1961 to 1995 of when the Rams were in Los Angeles and her husband Jim Murray was writing for the Los Angeles Times about the Rams. And she's got that coming out. We're going to talk to her about the Jim Murray. We'll talk a little bit more, touch a little bit, of course, on the Jim Murray Memorial Foundation Scholarship, which we always talk about, of course. But this is a special appearance by Linda because of the book, which is due out, I think is already out. But Linda's on the other end of our line. And by the way, just to let everybody in Michigan feel worse about the weather conditions, she's talking to us poolside, believe it or not. She says 91 degrees in California, and she said, "Well, I've got bad reception here, guys. I'm going to move to poolside," which was, to me, I think it was just a cheap excuse to let us know that she's poolside. Myself, I think that was just a ruse. So she's poolside, probably in a bathing suit, talking to us about this, probably sipping a nice tea or a pina colada or something out there in California, whatever she drinks out there. Linda, thanks for being with us, and we appreciate it. How you doing, my dear?
Doing just fine. And, you know, we both love martinis. So let's not think about.
You always. You're right. Martini is my drink.
Here.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. No, so martini is one of my drinks for sure. I love martinis. That's for sure.
Extra dry. We talk about our martinis on Facebook all the time.
Yes, so, we do.
Yeah. And hold the olives. You can put those on the side.
Well, and the Italians, like me, we don't even, you know, the vermouth is just a rumor. We just take the bottle of vermouth and wave it toward Rome. And that's close enough.
That's right. Just wave the cork over the.
Right. Exactly. Linda, the book is exciting because we talked about this last May when you were on the show and on the anniversary show. This was in the works. I know it's been in the works for really quite some time. Kind of walk us through the genesis of this, how you got the idea, how long this has really been in progress, because I know this has been a project that has been a labor of love, and it's taken you a bit of time to get it done. So kind of walk us through why you decided to do it and how long it took to get this thing to completion.
Right. Well, it's taken a little over a year, and when the Rams were definitely coming back to Los Angeles, said to me, I mean, older Rams fans who said, you know, Jim wrote so many wonderful columns in the Times, and why don't you take those columns and put them in a book? It's a walk down memory lane. It's history. It's wonderful. And a lot of the younger people think that the Rams left here, went to St. Louis, but they don't know that the Rams came from Cleveland to Los Angeles, and then they went St. Louis, and then back to Los Angeles.
Right.
So wonderful players that, you know, the Jack Youngbloods and the Fearsome Foursome and Merlin Olsen and Jackie Slater. I mean, you just go on and on and on about all the greats. And so I said, you know, it falls into my lap. I have to do the research, and I have to do the, you know, a lot of those columns were in microfiche. So everything has to be transcribed into a Word document, and then finding a publisher. And thankfully, we have a lot of wonderful people at USC who, through their bookstore, led us to Figueroa Press. and they have published the book, and now we have a distributor, and we're waiting for the link right now to get it up on the website to place the orders. But we've had really good response. I mean, we've talked about it. We've done a lot of social media on it, and once the book comes out, we were hoping it would be out before the Rams had their first home game. But of course, you know, the season is going into 2017-2018 now. So I don't think that there's ever really a bad time for
no.
As I say, it's 140 some columns about history.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you, what was the actual number of columns that you had to sort through, and how many made it into the book?
There's tons and tons of columns, but I think we settled on 142. I'm sure there are some that we have missed, but how do you, you're saying, you know, which one of your children do you like best? I mean,
right.
That's not fair. So I think there might be a couple Merlin Olsen columns in there, and, possible, but, you know, we couldn't have the, you know, the, just volumes after volumes of Rams columns, although they're all wonderful. And, but we will have book signings, and we will work through, you know, the Rams have been very receptive to the idea of maybe putting it in their gift shop at the Coliseum, and the Coliseum as well, because it's USC connected. And, you know, so we'll get it out there. And, and $5 from each of the book of the foundation.
Oh, great! That's terrific. That's saying yeah. something. That's a good chunk of per book. I wonder what Jim would say to the fact that you have a Rhodes Scholar writing the foreword to his book. Pat Hayden, the former Los Angeles Rams quarterback, of course, and UFC grad, and former, he's also the athletic director at SC, and he wrote the foreword. How did that come about that you got Pat Hayden to do the foreword?
Yeah. There again, it's sometimes it's who you know instead of what you know. And as I say, I went through Tim Tessalone at USC, and he put me in touch with Pat. And of course, Pat Hayden knew Jim Murray for many, many years, and was honored to write the foreword. And as you say, a Rhodes Scholar to a Pulitzer Prize winner. I mean,
yeah.
And, you know, now our Murray Scholars are benefiting from it. It's it just is a full circle, and I'm very happy and so honored that Pat Hayden would write the foreword. It's lovely. It's a lovely foreword.
Now, the book is – the actual hard copies, Linda, of the book. I know you mentioned a few minutes ago about the – you know, getting the link so the online purchases can be made. Is the book – the hard copy of the book, is it available in bookstores in California right now or no?
No, they are not in the bookstores right now.
Okay.
We are we're very, very close to launching. We're just got a few technical things to figure out with the links. And, I know it shouldn't be that difficult, but you know, there are certain things that have to be done, with our sites and their sites and so on and so forth. I don't know about the, intricate workings of the books, how they're published and so on and so forth.
We're talking with Linda McCoy-Murray, who's pumping her new book, The L.A. Rams Home Again, a compendium of columns written by her husband, Jim Murray, about the Los Angeles Rams when Jim wrote for the Los Angeles Times. I'm Greg Eno, and Big Al Beaton will be joining us in a couple of seconds here in this interview as well. We kind of know, I mean, the folks who read Jim Murray, and I, of course, I'm one of them, and the folks who knew where he stood about this, we all know where he stood on the Rams leaving Los Angeles. We all know where he stood on the city of Los Angeles not having an NFL franchise. We know, gassed at that. What was his, you know, being married to him, what was his personal, did he ever say anything to you about the Rams? I mean, was he really bitter? Was he as bitter about the Rams leaving Los Angeles as or maybe bitter is a strong word, but was he as upset about the Rams leaving Los Angeles as he wrote about in his columns? Did he take that kind of personally when the Rams left?
Oh, I think that was a huge, huge mistake. The Rams, and then when they went to St. Louis, you know, it was like when the Raiders went back to Oakland, and I think he really took it personally. You know, he lost the game, and I think even till the day he died, he didn't know if we would ever have a team coming back to Los Angeles. But he thought the market here, I mean, one of the strongest sports market in the country. How do you not have an NFL team?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that now, because I want to talk about that because and I want to address that when it comes to the Chargers. But let's get back to the Rams. Now, I know I don't obviously the results on the field weren't very good. The Rams were not very good on the field last year. But how I wasn't really paying attention, Linda. How was attendance this year for the Rams games first year back in L.A.?
Well, I think that, you know, the Rams fans are diehards. I mean, it's like the Cubs fans. I mean, you know, you just live and breathe for your team. And, I think initially they just flocked to the Coliseum to see those preseason games. And, overall, I think the fans were very supportive. And I think that as they come off their, know anything about trades and agents, free agencies, but, you know, I think that the fans will come. But the bottom line, Greg, as you know, is that he's getting a good defense. And I mean, look at the fearsome foursome. I don't think we'll ever see the likes of them again, but in a strong offense. And, you know, one of the things, our fans out here love the hometown talent. And we've got Robert Woods, who just made a 5-year deal with the Rams this past week. And, you know, he's disciplined, as I understand, and has a good work ethic. So I think it's a real plus for the organization, a player who could lead by example. You know, they all have to work in harmony. And, and I think that, you know, the jury's still out, but we'll wait and see. But I think that, as I say, they love the local talent. And Woods was born in Carson, California, and he was a USC wide receiver. So, mm-hmm. you know, there's a rooting interest for the local boy.
Well, I got to ask you this question, Linda, about the Chargers. They moved back to Los Angeles. Of course, everybody knows that was announced a couple months ago with not nearly the romanticism, of course, as the announcement of the St. Louis Rams moving to Los Angeles last year. I got to ask you point blank. Does the city of Los Angeles even want the Chargers? Do they even care about the Chargers?
Los Angeles does not care one iota about the Chargers.
I didn't think so.
Period. End of report.
So what's going on here? I mean, obviously this was a hissy fit that was thrown by the Chargers owner. Spanos. I mean, was this like because they wouldn't give him a new state? What was it, a stadium issue? What was the impetus behind doing this?
It had to be the stadium, pure and simple, because they're getting that new one.
Yeah, it's all about the new stadium, and it's I just have totally washed my hands of reading anything or caring about the Chargers.
Let's switch off the Chargers. And I, by the way, that answer you gave me is consistent with what I have read from the people in Los Angeles, the fans out there. And I can imagine what the Chargers, the San Diego faithful, must think. This just seems like a bad situation all the way around. There doesn't seem to be a winner here. You know, sometimes when a franchise moves from one city to another, even if it's close geographically, like the Raiders moving from Oakland to Los Angeles, there's some, you know, you can take something out of it, but it doesn't seem like in this particular instance with the Chargers moving from San Diego to Los Angeles, there doesn't seem to be any winners here. It's, you know, the Chargers fans are losing and the Rams, I mean, the LA people don't care. So there doesn't seem to be any winners here.
I can't answer that because it's ridiculous. But then I'm not an authority on what's going on behind the scenes. It's all about the stadium, however. And, I just don't think, you know, Los Angeles has too many options for the sports fans. I mean, we've got the Lakers, we got the Clippers, we got the Kings, we got the Ducks, we've got, we just got so many. We've got the Dodgers, we've got the Angels, and we've got skiing, we've got the beach, we've got horse racing, we've got so many options that, I mean, the discretionary income, are there enough Charger fans that are going to go attend those games. I don't think you're not going to have the Rams fans going to the Chargers games. They don't care.
Right. Right. Exactly. You know, and even though the Chargers, I think, spent 1 year, their first year in the AFL, I believe, was in Los Angeles, and they moved to San Diego after just 1 year in Los Angeles. They do not have, they by no stretch of the imagination have any ties to any romantic, emotional, you know, historical, nostalgic ties to Los Angeles, aside from that 1 year they spent in the AFL back in 1960. So this whole thing is just really, is really bizarre. Let's move on to something a little bit more cheerful. Get us caught up, Linda, what's on the news with the Jim Murray Memorial Foundation Scholarship. I know you've got a couple of new schools that are involved in the competition. Why don't you talk about that and what else is going on with the foundation?
Well, the two new schools, speaking of San Diego, we have San Diego,
San Diego State.
San Diego State. I was so pumped on the Chargers thing, I totally forgot my train of thought there. But we got the University of San Diego State University and University of Nebraska, Lincoln. They're the two new schools this year who will compete for our scholarships. We're really excited about bringing in. So that brings us up to 36 journalism schools across the nation participating in our annual essay competition. And our event is Saturday, September 30th, and it's our fifth year to have the event, and we'll announce our 2017 up to $5,000 scholarship. So, you know, it's huge. I mean, I never thought that we would grow to become what we are today.
I should mention to listeners, by the way, that if this interview sounds a little choppy, because in the post production here, Linda's talking to us from kind of the mountains out there in California, so the reception isn't the greatest. So we apologize for that. But I do want to, before we still have her on the line here, before I let her go, I want to ask her, or at least confirm with her, two things. Number one, how folks can get the book is to go through. There's two different ways people can get the LA Rams Home Again book. One is by going to the JimMurrayFoundation.org. That's JimMurrayFoundation.org. Or email Linda at Murray Scholars, that's M-U-R-R-A-Y Scholars, at AOL.com. And you can get the book that way. They'll set you up that way. And a reminder that for every book that's sold, $5 is going to go to the Jim Murray Memorial Foundation. So that's terrific. And I also want to mention, while I'm talking about Murray Scholars, if you haven't done so already, email Murray Scholars at AOL.com and tell them you want to be put on the list for the Mondays with Murray column that that Linda's son sends out every week. Bill does a great job of getting those columns together. He goes to the archives. He comes up with something. Usually it's germane to what's going on in today's sporting events. He comes up with something like around Masters time, he might come up with a Masters column and so forth. But just email them at murrayscholars@aol.com. Tell me you want to be put on the list. And I guarantee you every Monday you'll get a big smile on your face when you get that message in your inbox. I look forward to those columns so much. Linda, before we let you go, I want to ask you one thing, because I know you want to talk about this. You've got another book cooking possibly, and talk about that as well.
I will, but before I've got a news-breaking story. Every year, for the last 8 years, I've given you one of our news-breaking stories nobody knows but you first, right?
Okay.
Yep. Our honoree this year at the event is none other than Lynn Swann.
Ooh, nice. USC grad, nice.
Very good. Lynn is currently the USC athletic director, and, of course, he's a Hall of Fame wide receiver with USC and the Pittsburgh Steelers. And he will get our Great Ones Award this year, and I are very excited. Again,
absolutely.
one of the greats. He really is.
Absolutely.
So we could, now that you have that, I announced my marriage on your show, and all kinds of stuff, you know. So here we go. I always get excited when I talk to you guys. You're just the best. I tell everybody about the knee jerks, and they say, the who? I say, let me tell you about these guys.
Well, we get the same thing, too, so.
Yeah, right. I get that from my wife, so, I mean, you know.
Greg, you just share all your recipes with us, right? Okay, so the other news is we're doing a first Southern California Sports Broadcasters Women Who Cover Sports Luncheon on May 10th at Lakeside Golf Club in Toluca Lake, which is in Burbank, California. And it's exciting. I've been asked to serve on the executive committee. Randy Elkins is heading this up. And Ann Myers-Drysdale, as you know, was married to Don Drysdale and played basketball at UCLA and was the first woman to play for, well, drafted by the Pacers back in the day. And she's now with the announcer for the Phoenix Mercury. She'll be the moderator and keynote speaker. And Shelley Smith from ESPN will be one of the speakers. And we're hoping that Helene Elliott from the LA Times, who writes, she's their NHL hockey writer. And she's an NHL Hall of Famer in her own right. She's big. And so I'm really excited. It's going to be a really nice luncheon. And so when talking to Randy Elkins, I said, you know, this is a great time to talk about my book that's been on the back burner for 10 years. And it is a compilation of Jim's columns on women in sports. And he wrote about women athletes before a lot of the other writers did. And, I mean, he covering from, you know, tennis to golf to, you know, almost auto racing. Jim was, in the days, you know, it was just the way he wrote. It was never mean-spirited. So I think it's a study of his writing and how women have evolved into the 21st century. So I think it would be a marvelous book. Kind of peddled it to Book Expo several years ago, and it wasn't the right time. So now it is, and it's ready to go. Christine Brennan wrote the foreword for me. Martina gave a Navratilova gave a quote for the back of the book, as did Amy Alcott. Yeah, so I mean, it's really kind of a fun book, and even men would enjoy that. You know, you have one a day, like a vitamin, one column a day.
You know, that's terrific, and good luck with that. Congratulations on that. And we're going to be, of course, bringing you back in a couple of months anyway for the anniversary show. So I'm sure in May we'll talk about other things, and we'll talk about what else you got cooking. But thanks so much for spending the time with us. And once again, to get the book, The LA Rams Home Again, the compendium of columns that Jim Murray wrote for the Los Angeles Times about the Los Angeles Rams, go through the website, which is jimmurrayfoundation.org, or email them at murrayscholars@aol.com, and they can hook you up. Linda, thanks again, and be well.
Okay, thanks, guys.
Okay, again, we apologize for some of the drops in that phone call because of where Linda was situated. So, but we got through it, and we appreciate that, and we appreciate her doing that. And, you know, she continues to do great things with the foundation and with Jim, really carrying on Jim's legacy, which is admirable. Al, we've got if you're ready, we can do clue two of whose birthday is it.
Yeah, let's get that knocked out before we get to the meat and potatoes of the episode. So fire away.
Okay, now is that a play on words because I made pot roast tonight? Is that why you said that?
Yeah, I'm still hungry thinking about it. So
right. Okay, this person, Al, was born in 1956. He's 61 years old today. Like I said, he's not a Hall of Famer, but there are some folks who think he should be. He started out as a catcher, made his name as an outfielder, won two MVPs in a row. His entire career was in the National League. He won the 1982 and 1983 NL MVP awards. And he was a four-time Silver Slugger, and I don't know if I should give him more than that, and a five-time Gold Glove winner, seven-time All-Star.
Oh, good Lord. I really am something. This should be a MVP early 80s, 2 years in a row, 2 years running, was a catcher converted to outfield.
You know, his number is retired. His number is retired by the team that he played the most. He played 15 years for one team and then finished out with two other teams.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, this is killing me.
If there was a Hall of Fame for squeaky clean players who played the game, he would definitely be in the Hall of Fame.
Oh, geez. You know, I'm actually at a loss right now, you know, and I'm not going to cheat by looking it up. So I'm just going to wait for the third one because I am actually drawing a blank. It must be the weather. It's playing tricks with my brain or something. Okay. I'm just drawing a complete blank right now. I really
maybe the wind blew your memory out of your head.
Yeah, no damn kidding. All right, and with that, let's Let's move on to, we got a lot to cover here. So there's so much I could put on our show notes list for this week. You know, what's going on at the NCAA tournament actually announced. The seedings were announced right before we started recording. So this weekend was full of NCAA basketball. You know, Michigan actually it became kind of the story of the nation with their the accident their plane was in before on the way to the tournament and actually going to win the Big Ten tournament. And a lot of seeding controversy. We could talk about the Red Wings and what's going on with Anthony Mantha and Jeff Blashill. But we're going to try and stick to football and baseball just because those seem to have the majority of the topics we can talk about. And obviously the big one right now, as always, is the NFL. Because the NFL is great at, well, staying above the fold, as they say, and when it comes to headlines, 365 days a year. With the NFL this time around, free agency has opened up. So that means a lot of roster churn, a lot of moves have been made. And, Greg, the Lions actually made a pretty big splash, and they concentrated mostly on one specific part of the roster, and that's specifically the offensive line. As Bob Quinn, before free agency hit, you know, the Lions GM had mentioned that he didn't want an offensive line full of all young players. Because there was a lot of talk that the Lions would be looking for a guard or a tackle for the right side of the line to replace outgoing free agents Riley Reiff and Werry Warford, because it didn't look like he wanted to spend to keep those two, and he didn't want to have an extremely young offensive line where the veteran would have been the center, Travis Swanson, because you got two rookies on the left, and now you'd have to rebuild the right. Well, Greg, Quinn, I think, surprised everybody. I think they were surprised he maybe one splash signing. He came up with two. When free agency opened, he signed probably the best right tackle on the market, Baltimore Ravens Rick Wagner. Well, it was Ricky, but now Rick. He inked a 5-year deal. Believe the average is going to be about $9 million a year. Then today, a 3-year contract was agreed with basically the best right guard on the market, that being T.J. Lang of the Packers, who is he's a Detroit native. Looks like he really did want to come back here, and the Packers helped that by lowballing him on a contract offer. His deal is also in that $9 million range, according to all reports. So essentially, Greg, they flipped Riley Reiff and Larry Warford for Rick Wagner and T.J. Lang, for around the same, maybe a little bit more money than Warford and Riley Reiff would have gotten if they had been kept. But from all accounts, if you believe all the pundits and talking heads, the Lions really did a great job in upgrading the right side of their offensive line. And then you factor in the fact that they also signed in free agency the top blocking tight end, Darren Fells, who played the last couple years with the Cardinals. He's essentially tackle sized, and he's strictly signed as that complement to Eric Ebron, who will be the receiving tight end. He will be the blocking tight end. So between those three signings and then what he did last year, Greg, with the drafting of Graham Glasgow and Taylor Decker, he has completely rebuilt the offensive line in two off seasons. It remains to be seen how well it's all going to mesh, but he said, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to build from the inside out, and that's exactly what he's done. I find very little to complain about what he's done specifically with the offensive line in free agency here, because he wants the running game to be better. It has to be, because I think it was 30th in the NFL last year. Well, it can't help but be better by having some high-end free agents added to the offensive line. The games aren't won on paper, but on paper, these look like very, very good signings, Greg. So what do you think on this?
Well, you said it. You kind of capsulized it when you said that he essentially traded. If you would have asked any Lions fan during the course of the season, hey, would you, just as a hypothetical, if you asked any Lions fan, hey, would you trade Larry Warford and Riley Reiff for T.J. Lang and Rick Wagner? They would say, yeah, of course, absolutely. And that's exactly what Bob Quinn has done. There's going to be no, I don't see anyone finding any fault with either of these moves. I mean, the money is not outlandish. I know Rick Wagner is going to be paid as the highest paid, right tackle in the game, but he was slotted to be that. That wasn't something the Lions, you know, this wasn't one of those things where they bid against themselves. You know, this was Rick Wagner was going to be the highest paid right tackle somewhere. Right. So the Lions happen to be the team. And Lang's contract, from what I've seen, is not outlandish at all. Both of these guys are I think, still have some good football left in them. You might have a little bit of a
qualm. Yeah, they're old. And in lineman years, a good lineman will play well into his 30s. And
oh, yeah.
I believe Lang's only 30 and Wagner's like 27, 28. So there's a lot of tread left in the tires.
Absolutely. I remember Jack McCloskey told me one time, he said the reason why big men in the NBA traditionally, if their careers have lasted longer, if you look at big men, you know, they typically play, you know, it was not unusual to see them play deep into the 30s, even 40, is because they don't move like guards do or small forwards do. They're pretty much, you know, they just don't have the same kind of it's not as physically demanding on them, where it's the same thing with, you mentioned it with offensive linemen. You know, they can play, you're right, they can play deep into the 30s because even though it's definitely tough going in the trenches, they're not running downfield, they're not skill players, they're not they don't have that kind of skill set that erodes once you hit 30. So yeah, I mean, these guys both should have a lot of football left in them. And I don't think you're going to find a lot of folks, Al, around here that are going to complain about these moves. Lions of fans have long wanted that offensive line addressed. Now, the Lions, of course, have put a lot of – in the past, with past regimes, have put a lot of resources from the draft into the line. But it hasn't borne a lot of fruit. You know, we talk a lot about, you know, geez, the Lions don't have – they don't ever have any Pro Bowl quarterbacks, but they don't have any Pro Bowl linemen. I mean, I don't know how far you'd have to go back before you found the last Pro Bowl lineman, offensive lineman.
You probably have to go back to the Lomas Glover days.
Yeah, right. And that's a long, long time. And that's really embarrassing. I mean,
Lomas Brown, I got them combined.
even the Browns, for as bad as they've been, they can at least say, hey, we got Joe Thomas. I mean, the Lions just have not had any Pro Bowl type talent along the offensive line, and they've invested a lot of high draft picks, and one of them is leaving town, Riley Reiff, and he never really panned out. I'm surprised he got as much money as he did from the Vikings.
And the Vikings want to play him at left tackle, which
and
there's a reason why the Lions moved him from left tackle. He was average at best.
Well, you know, and with all due respect to Jeff Backus, who I admire for the length of time he played for the Lions, Riley Reiff, drafted in the first round when Jeff Backus was like 12 years into his career,
could not draft the last year of Backus's career, if I remember right.
Could not beat out Jeff Backus. I mean, if you're drafted first in the first round as a left tackle, and you can't beat out a guy who's in his 13th year, and that guy's not a perennial Pro Bowl, we're not talking Jackie Slater or, you know, anybody like that, you know, then you should be able to step in and win that starting job. He wasn't able to do it. So, you know, he's off to the Vikings, and I think the Lions are, at least like you said, on paper, seem to be better off than they were a week ago on the offensive line, just by virtue of these two moves. So it's definitely something that is refreshing. It's nice not to be going after receivers and, you know, tight ends. It's nice to be going after these guys that really, you know, make the hay. You go around the NFL, and all these good teams pretty much have one thing in common, and that's a good, solid, cohesive offensive line.
Yeah, exactly. And there's a couple reasons why the Lions can get away with this, and that's Glasgow and Decker are still in their rookie contracts. So they are essentially being under, you know, as NFL starters, they are relatively underpaid to consider to the veterans that you'll have on the right side. And you're going to overpay a little bit in free agency anyway. That's just how the game is played.
Right.
But, you know, it's still, when you average it all out, it still kind of works out. But, you know, you got a third-round pick in Glasgow who's, you know, if he's going to be a starting guard the way it looks, I mean, that, you know, a third-round pick, you're getting great value right there as well. And Decker is looking for all the world, like he could be a Pro Bowl caliber talent as well. And I think the other thing you can factor into this is that the team is not expecting much of anything at this point from former first-round pick Laken Tomlinson, who, at this point, I don't even know if he's going to if he's even going to be the backup, because they drafted Joe Dahl last year in the fifth round, right. And I think they'd like him better. Now, it's looking like Tomlinson is going to be the final bust in the Martin Mayhew. That's his legacy. That's his final big draft pick, and it looks like Tomlinson is just going to flame out big time, because at best, he's become their third or fourth offensive guard. At worst, he's not going to be on the team this year.
Right, and that's what I was talking about when I said they've invested a lot of draft resources and not have really not gotten a lot out of it. So it's not for a lack of – it's not like that they didn't have high draft picks on the line. They just didn't have, guys that played to their draft status. And Tomlinson for sure is one of those guys. And like you said, he at best he'll be a depth guy. How far he's fallen in just a couple of years. But right now it's not about Tomlinson, of course. It's about Lang, and it's about Wagner, and the only thing you can say about Lang, who visited Seattle, Green Bay, and I believe what was the third team? Was it just Seattle, Green Bay, and Detroit?
Green Bay, and Detroit, and it was. Okay. It looks for all the world that he was using Seattle to leverage Detroit.
Well, you know, you might say, well, why doesn't he just stay with Green Bay? Because they've got a more successful team, and they've beaten the pants off the Lions. But I think what the nice thing about Lang being a local guy is that he says, look, I used to be one of those. I know how hard the fans, or how badly the fans want a champion in Detroit. I was one of those guys. I was one of those fans. Of course, you know, he was born in Royal Oak. He went to Eastern Michigan. And so, of course, naturally, I like him. And so, you know, there's the connections there. And he said, look, I was one of these guys. I was one of these fans who, you know, lived and died with the Lions. And I know how badly this town wants a champion. And so, you know, that's another wrinkle to it, is that how often do you sign a guy of that caliber who knows what it's like, who can really feel the fans' pain? And that might have been the deciding factor between, you know, he's won a Super Bowl with the Packers. And, you know, he's tasted that. And now I think he's saying, look, I want my kids to grow up here. I want to try to win another Super Bowl in my hometown. And I think that was a large part of why he chose the Lions over returning to Green Bay.
Yeah, exactly. And plus, the Lions were the highest bidders. Period. You know, this is going to be his last big contract. You know, even if he does, you know, he plays through this 3 years and he wants to continue to play, the odds are at 33 or so, when the next contract comes up, he's not going to get the same kind of money. So, you know, it's football. You know, you got to make your money when you can. And it worked out best for Lang because the Lions gave him his best offer, and the Lions are his hometown team. So it's a great, great sign. I have no complaints. But we do need to bring up, Greg, is that I believe I saw on Facebook you brought this up. The Lions tried this tactic over 25 years ago or so, in the early 90s, did they not, with signing, I think, three free agent offensive linemen as starters? And it didn't work out as well, if I remember right.
That's correct. 1993 was the first year that the NFL went into their true free agency mode, where players could really – where they really were free agents to the degree where they could actually make some money. And the Lions in 93 signed three named guys at the time. Bill Frelick, who was a longtime Falcon, David Richards from the Chargers, who was in his prime, and Dave Lutz from the Chiefs, who was also a little bit long in the tooth, but they signed all three of these guys. And unfortunately, what they did was they all three of them were they played the same position. And so they had to move some guys from guard. I think they were all guards, and they made Richards or Lutz a tackle. And Frelick and Lutz only played in Detroit for 1 year, and Richards played three. But it didn't. Even though the Lions made the playoffs those 3 years, they just didn't. The line didn't really see the improvement that they thought they would. Guys were playing out of position. They wasn't cohesive. But now you've got Wagner, definitely a right tackle. Lang, definitely a right guard. And you go across the line, you've got Swanson. You've got Decker left tackle, and Glasgow will probably be the left guard. So now you've got some the makings, Al, of one of the NFL reporters wrote on, I think it was on ESPN or USA Today, the line for the Lions could be, for years after being a punchline for all these years, could be a strength.
Yeah, and it definitely plays now into – There was a fair amount of talk that the Lions were thinking about taking a running back fairly high. Now I would, you know, I would think twice about that, considering, one, they really, we'll talk about this in a little bit, we'll go in a little deeper, they really got to go big-time defense in the draft, and there's also the fact that I think they're planning that with this offensive line as currently constructed, that they should be able to get plenty of production from the backs they already have, which they should, because they have invested some, a fair amount of high draft picks with their running backs as well. It just hasn't worked out. You know, mostly due to the injury in this case, you know, especially with Amir Abdullah, who I think if there's a big if there's two people going to benefit from this, Greg, it's going to be obviously Matthew Stafford and Amir Abdullah. This offensive line works out the way we're all hoping. Those two are going to have big years. You know, Stafford is not going to be on his back and not going to be running for his life as much, and Abdullah is going to have some nice-sized holes to run through. And before he got hurt, he was averaging 5 yards a carry. This kind of has me excited for the season already now we're talking about it. Playing into all this, you know, as I brought up the draft, is that we got to bring up, I think, the most surprising, yet maybe not surprising move that the Lions have made this past week, and that was announcing that their starting outside linebacker, essentially for a few years there, he was their most impactful back seven guy, combined with Sue, was their best defensive, one of the two big defensive players, and that's DeAndre Levy. He is going to be waived post June 1st. That's all of a contractual salary cap thing. They're going to make it official June 1st, which frees up about $6 million in cap room for this season. There'll be some dead money, but it's manageable after that. I think like $2 or $3 million a year for the remainder of that contract. The thing is that Levy played at a Pro Bowl caliber level prior to signing the four-year contract after the 2014 season. It was a four-year contract extension. After he signed that contract, it was nothing but bad luck for DeAndre Levy. He played just five games over the past two seasons. This is one of those things where, after the fact, DeAndre Levy was honest about it. He says, they didn't offer me a pay cut. They just said, we want to move on. And he was blunt about it. He goes, it was probably, he said, because I have not been healthy for 2 years. And he even admitted he came back at the end of last year. I think he played the last two or three games. And he even said, I wasn't ready to play. They needed me. I played, but I was still hurt. So this is one of those things, Greg, where it's a football thing. Sometimes things just don't work out with very good players because of injuries. And in this case, I'm sad to see him go, and I was surprised that they decided to cut from him. But I wasn't surprised when you think about being off the field for essentially two years, and he's 30 years old, and he's got – if there's a player out there who is going to do other things with his life and his life is not going to revolve around football, it's going to be DeAndre Levy. So it would not surprise me that – he is not long for the NFL because he's got a lot of other things going on, and he's a smart guy. And the sooner Levy's career ends, the better it is for everybody. But it makes sense for the Lions just to move on from a guy they just don't think can stay healthy. And from all accounts, he can't.
Yeah, I mean, this happens in the NFL. I mean, you can't – you know, you want to give guys chances to come back from injury, and especially players who have the potential to be as good on the field as – DeAndre was for a time, but there comes a point, like you said, where you just have to say, look, you can't do it anymore. I mean, and it happens to a lot of players. You know, typically it's a skill position guy who just can't, you know, whether it's a knee injury or something that they just can't ever get past, and they try and try and they just can't do it. And you know, it's happening here. I mean, you just cannot, you know, certainly the Lions could not depend on him. It got to the point where they could not depend on him. And when you get to the point, Al, in a player's career where you when you're making up your depth chart and when you're trying to construct your roster, and with the draft coming up next month, and you have to make decisions about what positions, of course, you're going to draft for and so forth, you just can't have a big question mark hanging over a guy's head like that 2 years in a row. Now, you know, last year, and when I say, I shouldn't say last year, 2015, he missed virtually the whole year. But you had you say, okay, that happens. Last year at this time, DeAndre Levy was still very much a part of the Lions' plans. The thought was he could come back from that injury and that he would be healthy by training camp and that he would be healthy for the year. And that was the game plan. That was what everybody thought. So there was no reason last year to think otherwise. But now we're 2 years now in a row of no real dependency on DeAndre Levy, and just cannot, for such a crucial position, that he played. You just cannot operate like that as a football team. We all know it's a business, and I'm sure DeAndre understands that as well. And I'm sure there's no hard feelings either way. You can't get mad at the Lions. I mean, you can't. They gave him a couple of years. It just, you know, you can't. You know, you can't hold their feet to the fire. I mean, they have to move on. Yeah. And, you know, like you said, DeAndre's the kind of a guy that he probably won't play another down in the NFL and will probably be just fine with that. He'll go on, like you said, he'll go on and do other things. Smart guy and all that other stuff. So he'll be fine from that standpoint. He'll walk away from the game with his wits about him and everything, which is nice. Made a little bit of money along the way and so forth. But there comes a time where it just, you know, it was becoming kind of a, I don't know if a distraction is the right word, but it was becoming a real sore spot with everyone involved. The fans, you know, we talked, mm-hmm. you and I talked about this last fall about, right. you know, the Lions maybe making him, you know, maybe not really reporting truthfully the nature of his injury. And, you know, the whole thing just became kind of cancerous. And now this is really, I think, the only way to move on is to indeed cut him. I don't think you can go into yet another year and say, well, let's hope he comes back and plays, because you just can't do that with especially when you're trying to rebuild a defense that needs rebuilding.
The NFL is, you know, what have you done for me lately kind of league. You know, Levy would probably be great as a color commentator or talking head on the NFL, but I don't even think he wants to do that.
Right.
He sounds like the kind of guy who's just, you know, I think he's too smart to be a football player. I think is one of the best ways to put it. You know, he's not. He's just. He's very cerebral, and that's not the kind of guy who I think he knows what. You know, he came in the NFL to make some money, and he's going to get out with his wits intact, and then do what he wants to do, and more power to him. And the only problem is now this leaves the Lions woefully shorthanded at linebacker. They got Talir Whitehead, and who the hell else knows? An upcoming draft is going to be heavy, heavy, heavy. On defense, because they've made some signings. They've, you know, a few defensive line depth guys. I believe they signed a cornerback, kind of a third, fourth cornerback type of guy. Yeah, DJ Hayden, like a one-year prove me deal. They did sign a linebacker, Paul Warilow from the Falcons, and that's another one of those one-year prove me deals, because he's a guy who's been hurt. You know, same kind of things. He was an impact player for a couple years, got hurt. And the Falcons decided to move on. The Lions pick him up on a cheap deal. I also can think is they got to hope for a guy like Reuben Foster to drop the 21 or something, or get lucky in the draft like with Levy. Levy was a third-round pick. This draft is going to be nothing but cornerbacks, defensive linemen, and linebackers, because that's really what the Lions are lacking right now.
Yeah.
You know, they'll get some more depth signings, and Quinn has shown a good eye for those kind of players. You know, he found a handful last year that, for the most part, contributed to the Lions making the playoffs. But this is one of those things where right now the Lions' best defense is their offense, in that with this offensive line is that hopefully they'll be able just to hold on to the damn ball and keep the defense off the field.
Well, you know, if you're going to nitpick this offseason so far, you're going to say, well, geez, where's the commitment to the defense? But there has been. You mentioned those two pieces, those maybe the depth pieces you talked about with Hayden, Warlow. But, you know, hey, there's still the draft.
The draft. And they got like seven picks or so. You know,
yeah. And the Lions, they'll get some guys. And I think that what this does, Al, with the way Quinn is going about this, is he's going for substance over style, which I think fans around here have wanted for an awfully long time. You know, we've seen the glitzy glamour kind of picks, and it's, you know, it's just so obvious that the football games are won in the trenches. And, you know, of course the Lions need depth at linebacker. Of course they probably need some more help in the secondary. And yes, they need more speed on the edge defensively. No question about it. But there's the draft to still to be done. And frankly, Al, I know it's just, you know, it's usually hard to evaluate a team's draft before the second or third year afterwards. Mm-hmm. But I think the Lions did fairly well in last year's draft. I think they did pretty good last year. I think they've got some building blocks. They got some guys in the later rounds that I think could be valuable. They're creating some depth. And how many times have we talked about that on this program, about how the good teams seem to have depth? Guy goes down, next man up, and they don't lose a beat. And that's what you need in the NFL, because, you know, these guys just don't – nobody plays – all the time. You've got to have guys step in and fill in and give people a break here and there. And, the defensive line is a work in progress. Everything's a work in progress on the defensive side of the ball, of course, but there's still a lot. This is only March. There's still lots of work to be done between now and training camp starts.
Team is a work in progress. And Quinn, when he was hired, even said this is not going to be an overnight thing. And this is only his second offseason, and so far so good. He's doing exactly what he said, that he would build from the inside out, that he would be very picky as to where he placed his free agency money, and he's really shown to be able to do that. And right now, I have really no complaints of what he's done. All right, Greg, before we start talking some baseball, why don't we get to hopefully my mind will start working, and I'll get the third question here of the birthday game. Why don't you fire away?
Well, I think if I just say this one thing, I think you'll kind of get it. If you combine this with all the clues I've given you so far, okay. He played 15 years for the Atlanta Braves.
Oh, crap. Oh, geez. Dale Murphy.
Dale Murphy, yeah.
No, he is one of the best players that no one remembers. Just
and
because his prime was so short.
He's not in the Hall of Fame. Well, some people think he should be, but he... Mm-hmm. His career went downhill pretty rapidly when he was not really that old. And I think the last
early
4 or 5
30s,
years.
His decline hit.
And
it was,
yeah.
His decline hit. It was not just a slow decline. It was a cliff.
Right. And I think that worked against him. And a number of other factors worked against him. But, yeah, Dale Murphy was the answer. He's 61 years old today. And nobody who played baseball, I don't think, was as squeaky clean as Dale Murphy.
He is. He's one of the best players of the 80s that everybody's forgotten. And it's a shame because when he was at his peak, he was as good as a ball player as it was out there. But as you said, his peak was very short, and that's what's keeping him out of Hall of Fame. All right, Greg, while we're on baseball, good time to segue into what's going on in Lakeland, and it's not pretty. They won today, but I think it was their first victory in like 8 or 9 games. But there's some caveats involved. Obviously, one, it's spring training, and so I'm not quite so worried about that. But and, of course, the offense has gone sideways, as you like to say. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that the Tigers have 15 players in their organization in the WBC. This all leads to what's going on in pitching. And you've railed about the Tigers pitching, they'll go as far as their pitching as will take them. Well, here's we are with some 3 really big contracts that are causing some consternation as to what they're going to do. You've got Anibal Sanchez, Mike Pelfrey, and Mark Lowe.
Ugh.
Their contracts add up to about $35 million. Sanchez is leading the way in awfulness. With a 17.47 ERA and a whip over 3, he's getting up 4 home runs in a little over 5 innings pitched. If the Tigers release him, he will walk away with around $22 million between his salary for this year and a buyout for next year. Then you got Pelfrey, who admittedly pitched well today. That might have saved his bacon somewhat. But he's owed $8 million, and his ERA, thanks to today's good outing, is down to 8. And then you got Lowe, who was signed to help shore up the bullpen, and he's owed another $5.5 million for this year, and his ERA is pushing 8 at 7.36. Al Avila is on record saying the team will take their best pitchers north regardless of their contracts. None of the 3 are going to, it's not like, oh, let's send them to Toledo. It doesn't work that way with these guys. You have to release them. And no matter what happens if they get picked up, a team that picks them up can pay them the minimum in the Lions. The Tigers are on the hook for those monster contracts. The $20-some million for Sanchez, the $8 million for Pelfrey, and the $5.5 for Lowe. So, now the question is, Greg, can you picture the Tigers' ownership, which we don't know what they're going to do now because it's no longer Mike Ilitch, it's Chris Ilitch, his son. And he's saying all the right things right now, but we really don't know what's going to happen when it's time for the rubber to hit the road. In a perfect world, the Tigers let all 3 of these guys walk. Because you could really make the argument, specifically in the case of Sanchez and Pelfrey, that a big reason they missed the playoffs last year is that they gave those 2 pitchers far too many starts. In a right world, all 3 of those guys are given the walking papers. The Tigers eat $35 million, and also, and then their payroll is like $235 or something like that. The question is, will the Tigers actually do it? Because That's anybody, a billionaire is going to choke on a $35 million tab and you're not getting anything for it. But if the Tigers hope to compete this year and make a playoff run, which there's enough talent on this team to at the very least make a wild card run, they are on such a thin edge that they cannot afford to waste starts with guys who are essentially throwing batting practice. And if that means letting $35 million walk, you let $35 million walk. It's hard to think that ownership will allow all three guys to walk. I can at least see keeping one of them. The scary part, it might end up being the guy who's making the most and Sanchez, who has been the worst of the three. So as well as Anibal Sanchez has served the Tigers, he is obviously, as we talk about guys hitting a decline and hitting a cliff, Sanchez has hit that cliff when it comes to his decline. He is no longer the pitcher he was when he won the ERA title. Pelfrey was a mistake all the way around, and so was Lowe. So I would hope that the Tigers sense to say, we need to win as many games as possible. That includes winning games in April, and they can't afford to just throw April games away by throwing Sanchez and Pelfrey out there. I would hope that's what they decide. I'm just concerned that they won't do it.
Well, first of all, I'll go to my grave never understanding the Mike Pelfrey signing. Nobody will ever be able to convince me that that was a good signing, and nobody will ever be able to make a good argument for why that was necessary. 2 years, $16 million for a guy who's, you know, I could give his baseball card to a fifth grader, and the fifth grader would tell you this guy's no good. I mean, I don't know why they felt like they needed to give Mike Pelfrey $8 million a year for 2 years. I'll never understand that one. Never, ever, ever. This is not a guy, Al, who was once great and then had a couple of bad years. He was never good. Never good.
This
he was
is always one of those, they said the scouts see something and they were fooled.
He was never good. Now, he was obviously way back when he was considered at the time in Mike Pelfrey's career where he did have an upside. But that was long time ago. And I don't know why the Tigers felt like they had to do that. The Sanchez thing, I'm not going to get on their case about, because at the time he was one of the best pitchers in the game when they gave him that money.
Well, the thing with Lowe is that they gave him that money coming off a
crazy to Toronto at the end of. Yeah, so it's hard to go crazy over those two, but the Pelfrey thing I don't understand. Now, having said that, you mentioned the $35 million, and I guess what I would say to you about that is, you got to pick your poison here. Do you want to eat $35 million, just completely you wolf it down, or do you want to pay it and cost your team ball games, thereby costing your team a chance to make the postseason, thereby costing you a chance to get more revenue in the postseason? You have to pick your poison. I think you just eat the money. I mean, I don't know what you hit the nail on the head when you said. When you said that your piece about the April games, they mean just as much as they do in September, and you can't afford to throw games away, and that's what they would be doing if they throw these guys out there. I think that if you just look at it from a business standpoint, say, okay, I've got some assets here that if I use them could do me more harm than if I don't use them. So what would I rather do? Would I rather pay to not use them, thereby not doing my team that harm, or would I rather – continue to pay that money? Either way, I'm going to pay the money. I'm going to pay the money either way. So do I want to pay it to see these guys blow ball games, or I want to pay it and not have them blow ball games and put other guys in? To me, I know that's hard to do. It's easy for me and you and me to say, eat $35 million. But when you look at the big picture and look at what eating $35 million would do in the long term, potentially, you could come out ahead, or at least if not come out ahead, you wouldn't come out as bad off if these guys aren't on the team to sabotage games, and then you could potentially make your way into the play. Don't forget, this team was one game away from the playoffs last year. Right. Who knows what would have happened if they didn't have Sanchez and Pelfrey in the rotation? I mean, we don't know. I would be willing to try a Boyd and Norris scenario.
Yeah, and right now those two are pretty much leading the fourth and fifth starter race in Boyd and Norris.
Right. So, I would rather go with those guys.
Put it this way, don't they? Wins, you've heard the term wins above replace. All three of these guys are below league average, and if you believe sabermetrics, One war is worth $7 million. You get rid of three guys who were, you know, essentially giving you negative war last year, replace them, you make up, you're going to make up that one game it cost you the playoffs last year, essentially. So and I'm sure between the guys that got in camp right now, specifically Norris and Boyd, they're going to get more production out of those two combined than they would out of Pelfrey and Sanchez. That's pure and simple. And in the long run, that $35 million will be made up by attendance and possible playoff money. If you want to break it down to money, that's a good way to do it, if you ask me.
Al, the future of the Tigers pitching staff is not Mike Pelfrey and Anibal Sanchez. It's Matt Boyd and Daniel Norris. I mean, that's these guys were brought in those deadline day deals in 2015, precisely to be the future of the pitching staff. The pitching staff was going to morph into, you know, the Boyds of the world and the Fulmers of the world and the Norrises of the world. That's what they're here for. Yeah. And you're not going to – it would totally defeat that. Forget the money. Forget the money. We're just looking at what the future of the organization is about when it comes to the pitching staff. You got to throw Boyd and start to throw Boyd and Norris out there every fifth day and see what you have. I mean, they're both lefties, which is a bonus. I mean, you know, that's mm-hmm. that's never bad to have lefties in the rotation. If they, you know, it just isn't because so many hitters are left-handed, so many tough hitters are left-handed. So that's never a bad thing. And if that's the only way they're going to get better, and that's the only way you're going to find out what you got with these guys. And they've shown – each of them have shown glimpses that they can be pretty good. They're still – you know, they're still not there yet, but they've each shown in their own way they could be bona fide, you know, starting pitchers in the big leagues. And then you combine that with Fulmer, who we hope does not have a sophomore jinx. We hope is a healthy Zimmerman, although – Jordan Zimmerman got lit up the other day. It was like five runs in an inning and a third. It was awful. Mm-hmm. And Verlander, who, you know, we trust is going to be good again. Then you have maybe a rotation that could possibly compete. But if you stick Sanchez and Pelfrey out there, Al, every 5 days, it's going to tax your bullpen, number one. The balls are going to be flying out of the ballpark. These guys are going to be struggling to get through five innings. They're both going to be throwing 100 pitches by the fifth inning. You're going to have to use your bullpen for four innings every time those guys – guaranteed, four innings the bullpen's going to have to pitch every time those guys go out there. And you just can't run a bullpen that way. You can't have the manager using his bullpen four out of 44% of the games that these guys pitch, two-fifths of the rotation. 40% of the time you're using four innings worth of bullpen. You can't do that. That's not sustainable, and neither of them have shown recently. When I say neither of them, Pelfrey and Sanchez, neither of them have shown that they can be trusted beyond the fifth inning. Pelfrey, you know, is okay in the first once or maybe twice through the order, and then can get to, I don't know what his ERA is, and that third time through the order, his ERA has got to be nine. I mean, it's just awful. Mm-hmm. Sanchez never he's awful from the first pitch. So that's not sustainable. And if you're going to get fixated on, I don't want to eat the money, to me, that's just short-sighted. That's if you call yourself a businessman, to me, that's bad business. Yeah. That's bad business. I don't think that's prudent. I think it's bad business.
Exactly. You know, good business is winning games, pure and simple.
Right.
And you're not going to win games with these guys, and that means walking away from $35 million. Well, that's what they're going to have to do. Right. Even though I still think they'll probably end up keeping one or two of these guys, and they ultimately let Sanchez go, because Sanchez has just been god awful. At the very least, with Pelfrey, you might be able to hide him, you know, in long relief or something like that. But it remains to be seen.
Why would you want to pay $8 million for a long relief guy?
Because it's because they don't want to see. I know it's that. Good money after bad type thing, what they might be doing. But at this point, I would not be surprised if they go north with Pelfrey just because of that contract and then keep them on a short leash. But again, as I've said, I'm just saying that's, I would not surprise you if that's what they do. In a perfect world, they walk away from all these guys. I still have a feeling that at least one of them is going to stick just because of their contracts. And I think it's going to be Pelfrey because that seems to be the they might have a spot for him in long relief. And, you know, $8 million is less than 21. And also, you know, I'm guessing they'll figure out a way to at least keep one of these guys to keep that 30, instead of $35 million, make it 20-something million instead. But we'll put it this way. It's none of the options are good other than the best option is walking away from all these guys. It gets worse from there as you keep each one of them. So we'll see what happens. And I know in, down in Lakeland, they're very non-committal as to what they're going to do with the pitching staff right now. And a lot of it has to do because they need the arms in camp anyway because half the team's away at the World Baseball Classic. But that leads us to center field, Greg. Three of the contenders are, well, not playing very well. Mikey Matoak has a 2.37 OPS. Tyler Collins, who has also been hurt and has not been able to play much defense, is a 4.33 OPS. Andrew Goes is also in the low 400s of his OPS. Even though these guys are okay defensively, they really aren't putting it all together. Jacoby Jones, on the other hand, has played damn well. He's slugging, I believe, 6.11. He's hitting almost 400. And he's very raw defensively, and it might be kind of an adventure to have your most important outfield defensive outfield position manned by a raw rookie who is not a natural center fielder by trade. So it still looks like he's headed to Toledo. There are reports the Tigers are still actively seeking additional center field options from around the league. They're poking around, probably waiting to see if anybody gets cut, released. Maybe someone will be could be traded for a bag of balls. We don't know. It really looks like they still have not found a replacement for Cameron Maybin. And the in-house options are either a raw rookie who's going to make a ton of defensive mistakes, or three other guys who might give you decent defense but can't hit their way out of a paper bag for the most part. It'll be some sort of platoon. I had no problem with them releasing Cameron Maybin when they did because I was under the impression that they were going to find some sort of serviceable center fielder that might get him through a year or two. The Ben Revere's of the world, they'll find some guy for a $4 or $5 million contract. Well, they didn't even bother to do that, and now they're still don't have a true center fielder out there. So I don't know what the hell they're going to do, Greg, but right now they're center field situation looks like it might be one of the worst in baseball. In a game where they always want you want strength up the middle, specifically defensively, that's a huge, huge black hole they have defensively in center field. And that's what it looks right now.
Yeah, you know, they once they traded Maybin, which was early on in the offseason, was like the week of right after the World Series was ended, they traded Maybin. So they had really essentially the entire offseason to find a suitable replacement. Well, I think what they ended up doing, mm-hmm. Now, of course, at the time when that Maybin trade was made, we all thought that that was the first shoe that was going to drop in a whole series of shoes. We thought that was going to be – that was the start of the rebuild that we were – that was hinted at before the season even ended. So we thought, well, here we go. But they had the entire offseason to address center field. And I think what they tried to do, Al, is they thought that the situation was going to kind of take care of itself. You know, the guys would go to – they would report to spring training. The decisions would be made. You know, the guys would – the candidates would play. And somebody would emerge, and the decision would kind of play out that way. And then they rolled the dice. That was what was going to happen. And it turns out that they did not have, aside from Tyler Collins and Jacoby Jones and Ghosts, they didn't have anybody, and none of those three guys were earmarked. They were just there. They were just into the organization, three guys that could play center that happened to be in the organization. So they didn't really identify anybody. They didn't go into training camp, spring training, with a defined number one guy. None of those three guys were essentially – slotted above the other, although I guess if you held a gun to Brad Ausmus's head, he would put Collins first, and because of the Ghost thing with he can't hit and he had some issues off the field, and Jones is, like you said, he's very raw. So that's probably what he would have if they had to play the games. When everybody reported to training camp, then they had to play regular season games right off the bat. He probably would have started Collins, I'm guessing. But right. I think they were hoping that the situation would kind of be one of those deals where it just kind of takes care of itself, and somebody would emerge and is anointed and becomes. It's not worked out that way. Now Jones is, you know, like you said, he's raw. He's going to make mistakes. Center field in, and I've said this a thousand times, in Comerica Park. Will make you look silly if you don't. It'll make you look absolutely silly if you don't know what you're doing out there. And that we talked earlier about costing you ball games with Sanchez and Pelfrey. Well, you misplay enough balls in center field, you're gonna cost your team ball games as well. I mean, you can't. You know, you say what you will about Austin Jackson and about Maben and about Ghost, but all three of those guys had pretty good gloves, and all three of those guys could play the position. I know Maben, from a defensive metric standpoint, didn't grade out very well, but the eye test tells me that he has the wherewithal to play a good center field in the big leagues. Collins, I'm not sold on him. Jones, we've talked about, and Ghost. A reclamation project, you know, that's another, you know, he's got some baggage. Is he over it? We don't know. He butted heads with Lloyd McClendon when McClendon was the manager down in Toledo, and now McClendon's the hitting coach at the Tigers. So I don't know what's going to happen with that. You know, you like to think that at this point that they're going to seek help from outside the organization, like you said, somebody to just patch a hole for a year or two. But this is – I don't understand the whole Maben thing. Just – it was done so early in the offseason. It makes me feel like that was – it was supposed to be the start of a bunch of moves that for whatever reason the philosophy changed and
– Or the market, one of the two.
Or the market. But at the same time, Al, they didn't go out and get somebody else from outside the organization either. You mentioned Revere, and there are other guys out there that could have been had for not a lot of money. So they didn't do that either. So I think they just went into training camp thinking that of the pieces they had within the organization, somebody was going to, you know, rise to the fore. And it was really kind of not a realistic expectation to begin with, and it really hasn't shown to be that way.
Yeah, and the one that's closest to coming to rising to the fore is the one they – don't think is ready. So
right.
It's really a mess. And yeah. And I have a feeling that, you know, just to go back to your, you know, what changed, was it the philosophy or the market? If you go looking at the free agency and guys like, Edwin Encarnacion and, Jose Bautista had trouble finding a landing spot. You know, they were in the market a long time for the, agreed to deals. And those are the kind of players that the Tigers were similar type players that the Tigers were looking to trade. No, J.D. Martinez, very similar to those two. Miguel Cabrera, you know, if you want to go there. A guy who doesn't play very – is not a defensive stalwart but hits the cover off the ball, but essentially a slugger, but doesn't bring much else. It seems like those are the kind of guys, Greg, that baseball is moving away from them type, those types. And they're looking more and more for the – obviously, Mike Trout's the top of the line, you know, the Mercedes, the Rolls-Royce of that model. But more and more, the five-tool guys, I mean, legit five-tool guys, are getting those kind of contracts. And the sluggers really, in a kind of way, seem to be falling somewhat out of fashion. Was it Chris Carter, the guy who led the National League in home runs last year?
Right.
He ended up signing for a pittance, essentially, because that's all he does. Is he hits home? He's a modern day three true outcomes guy. You know, walks, strikes out, or home runs, and that's it.
Yeah.
And those are the kind of guys that the Tigers lineup is still full of.
Right.
And the market's not there anymore for him.
Right, yeah, Carter's a great example. And all he was able to muster was a one-year contract with the Yankees. And which might be a good fit for him because he'll hit a ton of home runs in that ballpark. That's a bandbox. But he'll also strike out 175 times if he plays every day. That's all he could get. Yeah. Granted, he was coming from a team that the Astros that did not have – or not the Astros, the Brewers, that did not have a big – payroll. So he wasn't probably going to get a big long-term deal from them anyway. And then once you left Milwaukee, you know, he didn't – it turns out that he didn't have a lot of interest from the other teams. And you're right. There seems to be a move away from those kind of one-dimensional players. You know, but these things go cyclical, you know. Yeah. Sometimes they're the – everybody has them and sometimes nobody has them. But you know, he doesn't play very good defense. That doesn't help his cause. It's not like he's a guy that you can live with because he's a gold glover. He's not that either. So he's limited to one thing, which is his job is to hit the ball out of the ballpark, and he'll do a lot of that with the Yankees. You know, frankly, if I'm the Yankees, that's not a bad move. I mean, you know,
but the thing is, if those kind of players, I think the Tigers are hoping, well, we can get a lot for JD Martinez. JD Martinez is a more skilled Chris Carter. But he's still pretty much a one-dimensional offensive ball player who's coming off essentially a horrific defensive year, if you believe the metrics. So I think that's where the market changed with the Tigers, is that they thought they could hold up teams for ransom for a guy as talented offensively as JD Martinez, and that kind of player is suddenly not quite so hot to trot on the market. Oh, are you there? Can you hear me?
I am.
Oh, okay. Are you?
You can just pick up your thought wherever you want.
Oh, you couldn't hear me?
No, I couldn't hear that. You dropped off. You were talking about how JD Martinez, the teams aren't really going for that kind of player anymore.
Yeah, okay. I'll go back again. All right. I'll just say. The Tigers thought that they could get a king's ransom for JD Martinez, who is admittedly a more talented all-around ball player than, say, a Chris Carter. But he's still fairly one-dimensional, that he's all offense, very little defense. He's coming off a career-worst defensive year. He was negative WAR defensively. That's how bad he was in right field last year. So, and all of a sudden, the market for those kind of one-dimensional players are drying up, specifically either the trade market and wanting to get pieces, or in the free agent market, where those kind of players, the Batistas of the world, got much smaller contracts than they would have 10 years ago.
That's a great example, by the way. I'm glad you brought up Batista, because it was last year at this time, he was kind of crowing to the media about, well, no hometown discount, I'm going to test the market, and, you know, I'm going to make all this money, and it didn't work out. His agent did a horrible job. They had an offer on the table. I can't remember what it was, from the Blue Jays, that they turned down. And he did not. He was lucky to get what he did get from the Blue Jays. I know he's a big hit over there in Toronto. They love him in Toronto. But he did not get the. Now he's older. Granted, he's 33, 34, but he did not get the money that he thought he was going to get. Not even from his own team. Right. So, you know, that's a great example. I'm glad you brought that up, because there were a couple of guys like that on the market this year that just, you know, we talked about Carter already, but Batista was another one that you'd see, geez, you know, what's going to happen with this guy? You know, why isn't he, you know, he turned down this money, and now he's, you know, kind of looking kind of bad here. His agent looked really bad in that.
Think about it. The Pirates couldn't trade Andrew McCutchen. You know, because of teams just – I think what it is more than anything else is that teams have realized they don't want to get locked into these long, possible albatross-type contracts. All the players we're talking about, those are the kind of deals they're looking for. And I think teams are starting to smarten up. And I have a feeling that now, especially now Mike Ilitch has passed on, the Tigers won't be giving those kind of deals anymore either.
Well, you're probably right. And I think, I think you're also right when you say that baseball owners are maybe starting to wise up a little bit. Of course, we've seen that before. Again, these things are cyclical.
Yeah,
they'll stop giving out the big contracts for a little while. Then they can't help themselves. All it takes is one guy to do it, and then everybody else does it again. They're like addicts. You know, they're like alcoholics who go sober for 6 months and then have a drink, sip of alcohol, and then they're back off the wagon again. So we'll see. But no, you're right. Now Martinez, I know what you're saying about the metrics, which I know I'm not as sold on defensive metrics as I am on offensive metrics. Right. I think JD Martinez is to me a very competent right fielder. I think he's got a good arm. I don't think he takes bad routes. I'm not sure where they're getting these metrics from, frankly, but I just think he's, you know, you could do a lot worse, let's put it this way, than JD Martinez in right field. Yeah. But the bottom line is he's, you know, still a guy. But I would also take umbrage with the notion that he's just a guy who hits the ball at the ballpark. He can hit. He'll hit 280 to 300, Al. I mean, he's not.
He'll give you a 900 OPS. That's awesome.
Exactly. And I don't know if those guys will ever go out of style. I mean, I'm sorry. I know that he's at the age now. Martinez is where he's got to make his hay financially.
And I think that's the other tipping point. He has hit it. That he's starting to push. He's getting closer to that age 30. Milestone. He's like, I think 28 now, and he's going to look for a contract that's going to take him well into his 30s and probably well into his decline. And I think that's the sort of thing that teams are getting worried about now.
Right.
He might not get as much as he hoped, much like we saw with guys like Bautista and Encarnacion.
Well, you know, you also have to look at Al. You have to look at a lot of teams in baseball have good lineups. They really do. You go across the board. You look at any given team's everyday nine-man lineup or eight-man lineup, whatever league you're talking about. A lot of teams, even the teams that are under 500, have pretty decent offenses. I think immediately of Colorado. They can score some runs. Arizona, I think once they get – they had some injuries last year. I think they can score some runs. But they're not a great team because they've got some issues with their pitching staff. So I don't know if there are too many teams – and this is what's going to hurt the market for guys like – JD, and we've already seen it with Bautista. I don't know that there's a lot of teams out there that are looking at a guy like JD Martinez and saying, you know what, we are a JD Martinez away from going deep in the playoffs. I don't think that teams look at it that way. I think teams will look at a pitcher and say, we're a Jake Arrieta away, or we're a Steven Strasburg away. But I don't know that they're looking at a guy like JD and saying, you know, if we only had a guy like that in the middle of our lineup, because a lot of teams have thump in the middle of their lineup. Now, the middle of the lineup for some teams may only be 3, 4, 5, where some teams can go deeper than that. But still, there are very few teams out there, although with the exception, I mean, the Cubs have got, you know, what's his face? Batting cleanup, the guy from Tampa that everybody loves,
Zobrist.
Zobrist batting cleanup. Yes. But for the most part, teams have guys who that's not what they lack. Okay, let's put it that way. So I don't know that they're looking at a guy like JD Martinez and salivating, waiting for him to come out to hit the free agency market. I don't know that that is really going on out there. And I think that's why you're seeing some of these guys like Chris Carter, you know, out there without a team come January. And how many times have you seen a defending, a reigning home run champion hit the free agency market and get no takers?
Yep. Yeah, exactly. It's the market is changing in baseball. And I think the front offices are getting younger and front offices are getting more metric friendly. And those are the kind of players that really don't play well when it comes to metrics, you know, especially the Carters of the world. And that's what's changing. I think it's going to show up in new long-term contracts. Different types of players are going to get that kind of money. And much like how awards have changed, it used to be the MVP was always whoever knocked in the most runs. That has changed as well. So we'll see what happens as goes on. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens with the Tigers. If they're not in contention, that's a trade deadline. And it's pretty much obvious at this point, JD Martinez is not coming back. They're not going to re-sign him. And if they're not in contention, they're going to have to unload him. I'm curious to see what his value actually is at a trade deadline. When things could change, when you're saying, you know, if there's a team, it only takes one team to say, we're JD Martinez away from winning the World Series. Hopefully that team is out there. It really is. But right. You're more likely to find that team at a trade deadline than you are in the offseason.
Right, because that's where you make your moves based on injuries. Maybe you're depleted. You need another bat for the stretch run. Maybe you go for a rental scenario in that case where you get a guy. Maybe you can catch lightning in a bottle and he gets hot. for a couple of months and adds that X factor to your lineup, yes. But from a, like you said, from a long-term standpoint, I think you also hit on something, you know, you kind of got lost in the shuffle, but when you talked about the metrics and about how baseball, look at all the GMs, Al, look at the GMs across the board in big league baseball now. They're not the old school guys anymore. You don't have these 60, 70 year old guys anymore that are GMs. You got GMs in their late 30s, early 30s in some cases.
They're all Billy Bean clones.
Right. They're younger guys that are, some of these guys are, you know, mid 30s, late 30s, early 40s, and they all subscribe, just about all of them, subscribe to metrics, which, you know, we can talk about metrics until we're blue in the face, but love them or hate them, metrics are here to stay. And these GMs now and the scouting guys and the player personnel guys and stuff swear by these metrics. And as you indicated, that's why you got guys like Ben Zobrist batting cleanup for the Cubs, who won the World Series, by the way. That's why you've got players like that are more valuable in those guys' eyes, in those executives' eyes, than the Chris Carters of the world and the GD.
That's why I think in metrics' eyes, the best player on the Tigers is Ian Kinsler.
Could be, sure.
He does it all.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Base running, fielding, hitting, absolutely. I don't know where he grades out. I'm sure he grades out very high defensively.
He was like a 6-7 WAR player last year. He led the Tigers.
Yeah, that's great.
The kind of player teams want nowadays, and
that's
where we're headed. And the Miguel Cabreras, I mean, they're going to be outliers more than what we've seen over the years. All right, Greg, I know we're getting late because we've had our fair share of technical difficulties.
Right.
And the WBC is still going to be going the next time we talk, and so will the NCAA tournament. And I'm sure we'll have lots to talk about when it comes to the tournament on our next podcast, because by our next podcast, it'll be I think we'll be heading into the Final Four. So with that, let's just start wrapping things up. And who is your jerk of the week?
Well, I tell you what, I don't, you know, sometimes it's low-hanging fruit to pick on media people, but I got to tell you, Bob Wojnarowski of the Detroit News, and this is not really for sports-related stuff. He was on Twitter.
Yeah, I know now, where you're going with this.
We had the storm. You and I touched on this storm, windstorm that we had on Wednesday, and how all the people, we were talking before the show about all the people in the Southeast Michigan area who lost power and or still don't have power and may not have power until Monday. And this was Wednesday, and Wojnarowski was on Twitter as early as Saturday, I think, or even Friday night, complaining about the amount of time it's taking to get the power restored.
Yeah.
And then he said, I don't know where he got this figure from. He said, we're in our fourth day now. I don't know where he gets this from. You know, the storm was, I don't know, whatever. And he had two or three tweets in a row where he was, you know, talking down DTE and complaining Jeff Moss, who I love, I love him. He's from the Detroit Sports Rack.
Yeah, he is a muckraker, superb muckraker.
Yeah, he called Wojo out and said, you know, I just love it when these, you know, pampered media types bitch about things like power outages. And, you know, and then a couple of people chimed in, thank goodness, on Twitter and said, you know, my father worked on the line and it's a lot of work and you don't know what you're talking about. Somebody else said that my uncle died because he was electrocuted. And you know, there are all sorts of things that I was glad to see people push back against Wojo. I was totally uncalled for. I don't know why you take to Twitter and bitch about power. I mean, it was the second worst power outage in the history of DTE. And I know, don't get me wrong, I even though I wasn't affected this time, we all know we've all been affected by power outages, and they do suck. There's no question about it, especially when you've got food that goes bad and fish that die and the whole nine yards. But to take to Twitter and essentially it's like bitching about a traffic jam. There's nothing you can do about it. You can go on Twitter all you want and say this traffic jam is ridiculous. There's nothing some things in life that you just have to wait out. And you got to know that these guys are out there. They brought in crews from all over the Midwest to help out. And they worked around the clock. If anybody suggests that they weren't, which is kind of what Wojo was suggesting, which I really bothered me. So my jerk of the week is Wojnarowski for just bitching about the power outage.
Yeah. You know, he's not a dumb man, but I think with Wojo is that the fat dumb guy shtick I think, is really become, you know, that's a shtick on the radio, and he sometimes does it on you know, either when he writes or on social media. It's become, it was what was once funny is now grating. And you're right. I saw some of those tweets where he was complaining and about the power outage, and I saw after the fact he's taking pictures of thawed out food that he has to throw out. It was ridiculous. You're right. It was stupid.
He's the only one affected by it.
Only one, exactly. You know, and he's a, you know, a single guy, and as far as I know, he's never said anything about having.
I'm sure he makes a lot. I'm sure he's compensated quite well by the news, by the way, and by the radio station.
Well, two incomes. He's got that damn radio show as well. Where I know, I have a feeling that being part of sports talk radio has done something to his brain. Where, as we know of sports talk radio guys, they tend to spew asinine things all over the place, and he did it. I'm with you on this one. That's a great call of Wojnarowski, because it was he just made an ass of himself on social media. He needs to take a step back and figure out what the hell he's doing, because what he did during the power outage, you're right, it was awful, and he was deservedly called out on it. All right, my jerk of the week, I could go all kinds of different ways. I could go on about the WBC, you know, this World Baseball Classic that no American fan cares about. ask Royals fans how they feel after seeing Salvador Perez limp off, have to limp off the field after hurting his knee last night. Or the Tigers fans who went to a panic all of a sudden when K-Rod pulled a groin. It's getting completely overshadowed because everybody's watching basketball right now. Who cares about games that really don't mean anything?
Right.
Or I could go, towards, Minnesota got a number 5 seed. How the hell did that happen in the NCAAs? But I'm going to go on a little more serious topic, and that would be it kind of got overshadowed because of all that's going on, specifically with the basketball conference tournaments and the NFL free agency, was that NFL teams there's a lawsuit going out right now of 1,800 players, former NFL players. There are plaintiffs from all 32 NFL teams saying that NFL teams violated prescription drug laws. And if you look into some of the articles out there, this was first reported by the Washington Post, and a lot of other organizations have dived deep into it, like Deadspin, things like that, other news organizations. And the amount of drugs that NFL teams are pumping into their players to keep them on the field. Well, if my doctor gave me, there was one story where a player ended up taking 1,500 milligrams of a painkiller. 750, one half, 750, before the game, 750 at halftime. If my own doctor did something like that, he would probably be, he'd be in jail right now for over-prescribing opioids. And it just goes to show just how out of control the NFL is, essentially, that they are abusing their players. But the only way they can keep these guys on the field, I put it this way, if the only way you can keep your players on the field is pumping them full of massive amounts of opioids, addictive painkillers, there's a major problem they got to figure out. This is one of those reasons why I have a feeling that the NFL as we know it is not going to be the same thing 20, 30 years from now because of stuff like this. Laws are being broken just to keep guys on the field. I mean, I take opiates every day because I have a debilitating disease myself. I take – it's minuscule compared to what these guys are taking to stay on the field. And what happens to these guys once they leave the game? They're addicts. So my jerk of the week is the NFL for what they're doing with drugs, specifically prescription drugs, the Vicodins of the world, that are essentially, I've said it again and again, NFL players are essentially pieces of meat. Once that meat gets worn out, they just move on from you. But it's a damn shame, and I hope this should get much more attention, and I hope it does as it comes closer to trial, that when this lawsuit finally makes it to trial, that all hell's going to break loose at the NFL as to how they handle drugs. Because right now it's out of control, and we're not talking, like it was in the '80s and cocaine with baseball or anything like that, or someone like that wide receiver for Cleveland who's pretty much been blackballed for life because he likes weed. It's ridiculous. So my jerk of the week is the NFL for their abuse of opioids and painkillers because they're killing their own players. Pure and simple.
That's a good one, and I didn't really know about that, so thank you for bringing that to light. I wonder, Al, and this probably wouldn't pass legal muster, but I wonder if the NFL wouldn't consider limiting, setting a cap on how many years you can play in the NFL. I wonder if down the line we won't see a rule that says you can only be an NFL player for 5 or 7 years. I know that
contract or something like that.
I wonder, and I probably wouldn't pass the muster legally, but I wonder if they would eventually consider saying you're done. It's kind of like a congressman, you that have term limits in those states that do. You know, you play, I don't know what the years would be, but you play and you're out, you're done. You can't play any further than that. Now, again, that would probably be challenged left and right because what you're doing essentially is, saying to somebody you can only earn a living at your profession for X amount of years, and there is nowhere else other than politics where you can do that legally. So probably that wouldn't. But I'm just wondering if it gets so bad physically with these guys with the concussions and the head trauma and what have you, if the players' union would even consider saying, well, they probably wouldn't be the ones, but somebody would consider saying, look, you play X amount of years and you're done. For your own good. For your own good, you can only play a certain amount of years. But that probably won't happen. But I'm just wondering if – because I just don't know with what you just said and with all the head injuries and everything and the guys committing suicide. And I don't – it just becomes – we talked about Levy earlier who is probably just as happy as anybody to walk away from the game, which is probably what he's going to do. I don't – I just wonder about it.
It's to the point now where I'm thinking a few generations down the line that – we may not even have a football, the way it is today, just because, there's probably kids who, when we grew up, you wanted to play football, but we didn't know the dangers about it either back then. Today, you're seeing, I think, it's going to happen where people are just going to say, I don't want to play, like foot basketball. Remember decades ago, boxing was probably the number. If you're a heavyweight champion of the world, you were the most famous athlete in the world.
Right.
No one boxes anymore because it's freaking dangerous. Could you even name who the heavyweight champion
is? No, not at all.
I can see football heading down. It takes decades for that to happen, but I can see football going down the same way as boxing has. Such a toll on people that they can't continue the way they are.
Well, one thing the NFL could maybe consider doing is adapting the high school and college rules that say as soon as your knee touches the ground, you're down.
And shorten the season.
Shorten the season. Once you hit your knee hits the ground or your elbow, you're down.
Because what college plays 12 games? High schools play 10.
Right, and that would be you'd still have hitting, of course, but for those guys whose knee touched the ground. By their own volition or because they weren't hit, sometimes that's where they are the most vulnerable. And that's one way to eliminate some hitting. I know you're going to get a lot of people that are going to say, the wussification of the sport and what have you. But anyway, that's a whole other discussion. I want to thank Linda McCoy-Murray for joining us early in the program and talking about her new book and what she's got going on with the foundation and so forth. And we appreciate that. And we apologize to the listeners for the quality at times of that interview because of where she was speaking from. But that couldn't be helped. 2 weeks from tonight, the 26th, I don't know who we'll have on as a guest, if we will have a guest. So we'll keep you posted on that. Read me at Out of Bounds, my WordPress blog and also the Winged Wheeler, my Red Wings blog. Follow me on Twitter at Greg Eno. Follow the Knee Jerks at the Knee Jerks. And our Facebook fan page is facebook.com/the Knee Jerks. I want to thank my lovely wife, Sharon. And thank you, Big Al, for making Sunday night so gosh darn fun.
Indeed, Greg. Thank you for putting up for my long-winded rants, as usual. And I just want to give a shout-out to my girlfriend, Linda, who's had a very bad week, much in part because of the weather we had here. One dog passed away, and the other one was almost killed thanks to the storm. But so I hope all is well of her. I will talk to her later. And, of course, I just want to thank all you listeners out there, and hope you're all safe and sound and have your power back. Let's wrap things up. We'll see you in a couple weeks. So until that time, this is Al Beaton saying good evening, good luck, and aloha.
Ciao, everybody. We'll see you in 2 weeks.